TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Kevin Anderson, a rule book for the climate casino. Even though climate scientist Kevin Anderson has given up flying, he attended via train and ferry most of the annual COPs, the conferences of the parties. They're held under the auspices of the United Nations Framework on Climate Change. And as deputy director of the Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research in the UK, he contributes to the science. Kevin Anderson says that we have known since 1990 about the need to end fossil fuel use. However, now, 28 years later, emissions of greenhouse gases are still going up and are a staggering 65% higher than in 1990. Kevin Anderson is very clear about the reasons why the industrial and political powers in the world are preventing the phase-out of fossil fuel use. And he calls out some of them in this panel discussion. But he also presents a statistic that he finds empowering. The economist Piketty in Carbon and Inequality found that only 10% of world population are responsible for 30% of CO2 emissions. That, of course, includes the now infamous 1% with their personal jets, fleets of gas-guzzling cars, and multiple McMansions. But it also includes people like us. You will hear in a moment a panelist ask Anderson if academics are part of the 10%. And yes, on a world scale, compared with people who barely have enough water and food, this gives many of us personal responsibility and agency and opportunity. Kevin Anderson also points to the economics of growth that are preventing the phase-out of fossil fuels and can even destroy efforts such as green development initiatives as long as they also promise growth. Plus, amazingly, in such a short presentation, Anderson and the panelists have scathing criticism of the techno-fixes that protect the current economic system and delay action. They promise that as yet unproven technologies will suck the CO2 back out of the atmosphere. You will hear Anderson's take on BECCS, bioenergy with carbon capture and storage. The conversation with Kevin Anderson was recorded at the 2018 COP in Poland. He was the guest on a panel organized by the United Planet Faith and Science Initiative. Here's Kevin Anderson.
We are 28 years now on since the first report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The emissions are probably at 65% higher and are still going up. And we still meet in these events like this, and we still say the same things we've been saying for pretty much 28 years.
Well, thank you all for coming to the another Scientists Warning TV program here from COP24 in Katowice, Poland. The hosts today, Victoria Hirth, who's an associate professor of sustainable business at the University of Plymouth, and my name's Stuart Scott. I'm the executive director of ScientistsWarning.org and a member of Survival University. And our guests today, very pleased to have with us, Professor Kevin Anderson, who's deputy director of the Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research, and he is associated with the faculties of the universities of Manchester and Uppsala in Sweden. And with him, Dr. Hugh Hunt at the Department of Engineering at Cambridge University. Today's program, a rule book for the climate casino.
Imagine that we actually thought climate change was a real existential threat, a real serious issue. And so we put in regulations at a global level so that the top 10% of global emitters had to reduce their carbon footprint to the level of the average European person. So just the top 10% of high emitters down to the level of the average European. And the other 90% of the world's population made no reduction in their current level of emissions.
Okay, so when you say the top 10%, are we in that top 10%?
We probably are. We're probably definitely in the top 20%. We may well be in the top 10, depending exactly what we do. But yes, people like us.
So the top 10%, we're talking about people who have high consumption lifestyles. They fly a lot. They travel a lot. They have perhaps more than two homes. More than one home.
Yeah, but certainly more than one home, yes.
Well, I was just going to say, the figures about 10 years ago, that if you had about £53,000 worth of assets, you were in the top 10%.
Okay.
As a ballpark.
Yeah.
So the question then is, if these people were to reduce their emissions to the European average.
Yeah, the European average. Yeah, a lot of the people in Europe, I think the average person in Europe is a reasonable, comfortable person.
And so what you're saying is the figure that you've got on that slide is that if that happened, then that's one-third off global emissions.
Yeah, one-third. And I think what's important there is that if you look at the Paris Agreement, all the pledges that were made by all the countries around the world, that's for virtually no reduction by 2030. So what I'm simply saying here is this isn't going to solve climate change. But if we thought it was a really serious issue, just 10% reducing to the level of the average European is a one-third cut in global emissions. Now, as I say, we have to do a lot more than that, but that would be a very good start.
Well, so the idea that we kind of know who these high emitters are they're wealthy people?
Well, we wouldn't call them wealthy, because they're our friends and our family, probably. The communities we work within, that most of those people are probably relatively wealthy. So, but it's not, I mean, it's not just about them. The whole mindset that has driven for at least the last 30 or 40 years, how virtually all governments now think about these issues, this sort of Davos mentality. You can call it the socioeconomic model or the neoliberal model, but basically it's one of ongoing growth with very high levels of inequality at a global level, but even within countries, very high levels of inequality. That's the norm that we've got now that we daren't question. So almost that's a given.
It's a given because we've got our pensions are hooked up in economic growth, the future. We just assume that the things that we own now will be more valuable in 10 years' time. I mean, yeah. It's kind of the norm. But how does that link into climate change?
Yeah, I mean, there's very clear links between economic growth and our carbon emissions. We've gone from this sort of Davos world where you've got these incredibly wealthy people turning up once a year at Davos and discussing world problems like hunger and poverty with no understanding of the irony of that, really, that these are the people that in many respects are causing the problems because of their completely profligate level of consumption, and that they've set a model that the rest of us are all aspiring to. We'll probably never get there, but we're all aspiring to that. And what I would argue is that hasn't the COP and the way we're dealing with climate change sort of become part of that? That what we have is this, I call them climate glitterati, that claim to be concerned about climate change, and it can always be solved by some technology in the future. So there's no problem with them and how they live their lives, but they like the idea of rubbing shoulders with the people from Davos. There's this whole sort of prestige that is passed down from this group of elites, this climate glitterati group, and that if you like, cascades down through the whole system. So we're all now developing solutions that don't question the current economic model. We can't question that.
So the recent IPCC 1.5 degree report is full of lots of technologies, negative emissions technologies, BECCS, bioenergy with carbon capture and storage, that the models seem to be that we're not going to change our habits much, so we're going to need technologies to achieve the Paris Agreement. Now, the problem surely with these technologies is that they don't exist yet. The climate casino is we're gambling on there being technical solutions to do these negative emissions, and if not, then what happens?
Well, there's two gambles. We're gambling, firstly, that they will work, and they will work at huge planetary scale. And just to give some feeling of that, you're talking about hundreds of billions, even up to maybe a trillion tons of carbon dioxide sucked out of the atmosphere by these technologies that we do not have at the moment. But on top of that, because we know they're going to happen later in the century, when people like you and I are retired, and that we hope that in the interim, that the feedbacks in the climate system will not make the situation much worse. So rather than reduce our emissions today very significantly, we're going to hope, we're going to gamble, the feedbacks aren't going to be very great, and that we're then going to have these technologies in years to come.
Well, so you were saying earlier that if the top 10% of emitters were to reduce their emissions to the average EU European level...
Yeah. Not voluntarily, I don't think.
Well, yeah, OK, we'll have to give them a little bit of a nudge. But that would be one-third of our emissions. So that's about 10 billion tons of CO2 every year. That's what, that's...
A bit more than that, but yes, yeah.
So thereabouts. So that's in 10 years, that's 100 billion tons. I mean, that's a trillion tons for the century, in a century.
I mean, yes.
So we can solve the problem.
Before you go on, you were talking about negative emissions technologies. Yeah. They exist or they don't yet exist?
Well, they do, but not on a scale that we need them on. For example, one negative emissions technology is to plant lots of trees, which sucks CO2 out of the atmosphere, burn those trees in our power stations instead of burning coal, and then capture the CO2 from the chimneys and put that CO2 underground. So that's bioenergy with carbon capture and storage. Well, that's a negative emissions technology because the CO2 is coming in into your biomass, into your trees, and then it's ending up underground.
So the trees are sucking up the carbon. So it's fair to say that negative emissions technologies suck CO2?
Yes. Yeah. So they do. And the scale we're talking about, we're currently emitting of the order of, say, 40 billion tons of CO2 per year globally. If we're going to make an impact on that 40 billion tons using negative emissions technologies, we've got to create a new industry that is on that kind of scale. So 10 billion tons would be pretty good. But inventing a new industry that can handle 10 billion tons of CO2, we're not going to do that in the next 5 years, next 10 years. We'd be lucky if we did that in the next 50 years. But the time scale is so long. So,
and the system implications. I mean, people look at these things and you just think, on average, biofuel, biomass, has about 1/4 the energy density of say, typical fossil fuel. And yet a huge amount of the ships traveling around the world are carrying fossil fuels. If you're going to move from fossil fuels to biomass, you're going to have a massive increase in the amount of shipping, all the ports that are going to be available, all of that infrastructure. So when we have these models, you press the button and that infrastructure exists. In reality, of course, that infrastructure takes maybe a decade or two decades just to build.
So, I mean, at a company level, you'd look at the energy pyramid if you were trying to deal with issues of energy. And the first thing that you would do is you would consume less because it's the cheapest thing to do.
Yeah.
But what you're saying is that at a global level, because consuming less doesn't fit the economic growth paradigm, we are bypassing that very clear, easy win and moving straight to investment decisions that create new industries that might or might not come about.
Yeah. I think we have to bear in mind it's not just that they're only relying on these models on negative emissions. There are plenty of other things as well. But actually it comes back to some ways the same sort of approach. A lot of people are discussing carbon taxes. Now, sometimes you can have a carbon tax that you can arrange to have the revenue go back to the population more generally, and that's less problematic. There are some benefits of that. But often people just about adding a carbon tax, and if you put the price up, then we consume less. But then you start to think, well, who's the we there? Again, we're perfectly aware that you and I are not going to consume less if you increase the price of fossil fuels, not any reasonable margin. We're going to carry on just paying the bill. But the poorer people, the 20% of houses in the UK in fuel poverty, they'll consume slightly less. We're not going to solve climate change. So, in fact, again, is this issue, the wealthy don't want to consume less, but we do think the carbon tax will squeeze the emissions out of the poor people, but without really thinking of the maths through that, because at the end of the day, the poor people aren't hardly emitting, as we're going to show in a slide in a minute.
So what's an alternative to the carbon tax that would therefore allow, would get over that issue?
Let's be blunt about climate change. We have a certain carbon budget, total amount of carbon dioxide we can spend over the century.
But that's essentially what was agreed in Paris.
That's effectively what's agreed in Paris, yeah.
And what we've had recently, this 1.5 report from the IPCC, is giving us ways of achieving this. But if we don't use the negative emissions technologies, what we've got to do is the high emitters have got to emit less, is this equity concept.
Yeah, we've got to ration it out. What we have is, if we want to meet our Paris commitments, and there are very good reasons to meet those commitments, then we have a carbon ration, a global carbon ration. And you can divide that out between countries, but also I think it's interesting how we divide that out amongst individuals, amongst high emitters. I'm not saying we should only consider it that way, but I think that's important.
So something like tradable energy quotas?
Something like that, some sort of mechanism that allows us to have a fair rationing system. So if we accept we must meet the Paris Agreement, if we accept the broad science coming from the IPCC, you are left with this difficult and uncomfortable position that you have to have some form of rationing. And then when you look at the emissions, how they're skewed, and that plays back to the little experiment at the beginning, you can see here the emissions curve. So this is for the different income groups, and you see that emissions are massively skewed to the top 10, 20, perhaps 30%. So 70% of global emissions, 70% come from about the top 10% of global emitters. And remember, these don't just live in the wealthy parts of the world. There are plenty of people living in China and India and other countries now who are also very, very high emitters.
Apparently, the World Bank only a couple of weeks ago said it was doing away with the term developing countries because precisely of that issue, yeah, that wealth is so skewed within countries and across countries.
Yes, yeah. But clearly, the averages are still very different between countries as well. So I think it's worth bearing that in mind.
So what this figure that you mentioned before about it, reducing emissions to that of the average European, and that's somewhere around eight tons of CO2 per person per year?
Yeah, 7 to 8 tons. Okay, territorially, that's okay. just within the boundaries of, say, Europe. If you take account of our imports and exports and everything else, it comes a bit higher, maybe 10 or 11.
Let's just unpick that figure of 8 tons. Somehow we think it's a real infringement on us as individuals to reduce our CO2 waste from 50 tons a year down to 8 tons a year, because somehow it's our right in some way, because we are economically driven to emit this CO2.
But I think it's interesting that our whole argument about rights there, what we mean is it's a right for those of us that can afford it to carry on doing it. But already the rights to use energy to improve the quality of life for many poor people is already taken away simply because they can't afford it. So our society is already very happy to have people who cannot afford to enough energy to live good qualities of lives. And that is including in wealthy parts of the world as well, poorer people in those countries and also elsewhere in the world. So we're happy for them to be constrained, but we're not happy for us, the wealthy ones, at the top of this curve to be constrained.
So what are the things that us wealthy people have to do to take this action?
Well, firstly, it's got to be done virtually immediately. You know, if we're doing now and the next, say, 5 years, that's the really important part. If we're going to come off the curve really fast, then you cannot do that with technologies in the first 5 years. So that's why I often make the point, the first 5 years, the thing you've got to do is drive down changes in behaviour by the very high emitters. And that, there's real scope, when you look at that, for actually driving those emissions down if we're serious about Paris. And when we talk about what does that mean, that means things like we will have to forego a lot of what we might think of as normal things, but most other people will see as luxuries. You know, those large cars, the regular flights, the business class flights, you know, having second homes, having very large homes, the very high levels of consumption, the things we've normalised, and we use the language of we're worth it. You know, we think we're worth it, other people aren't.
So I go to the supermarket and it says, special this week, 3-for-1 mangoes. And I think, oh, mangoes, they're nice. So how do those mangoes get from wherever they grow to the supermarket in England or in Poland or... And we just don't think about it. Where does the coffee come from? Where do the peanuts come from? It's just taken for granted that we can just get these things.
Yeah.
We have to start thinking about these things very differently.
But also, then when we get them home, you know, we'll take those mangoes, we'll put them in our nice large car, possibly a four-wheel drive, to keep the children protected when we drive them to school. We'll drive them back to our large house, open our double-door refrigerator so we can store our mangoes in there. At every single level, we've normalised very, very high levels of consumption. And so we're going to have to change that very rapidly indeed. So the argument I often make is if we are serious about climate change, which does, of course, require lots of technologies, then we've got to make this transfer of the labour and the resources that at the moment furnish the relative luxuries of the people at the top of this curve, people like us. The labour and the resources that are furnishing that part of our life are going to be required for making this massive shift to a decarbonised energy infrastructure.
But it's people like us who are making the decisions.
That is the biggest problem, I think. And that's why, to me, having people who are not that wealthy, having their voices heard is really important. And here, probably the most potent voice in the whole of COP24 has been that of a 15-year-old girl, has been Greta, who's raising these very difficult questions to people like us and to her own parents. So there are plenty of people out there who can voice that concern, and we need to make they need to grab that power, make that space to be heard.
So do we maybe need to adhere to one of the major rules of good governance, which is removing conflicts of interest?
Well,
from the process.
Yeah. I'd certainly be very good if we could move conflicts of interest. Well, They're often quite hidden as well.
One thing I don't hear is climate scientists coming out and saying what they really think. Because presumably, surely, the modellers, the people who are doing the underlying climate modelling, are absolutely 100% aware of the things that we're saying. But we don't hear them say it.
Well, I hear them say it quite often.
But in places like this?
No. If you put a microphone in front of someone or ask them to write something on a piece of paper or type something on their computer to go into the public domain, no, they won't say this. Right. They'll say something that nicely fits with the Davos model. But actually away from that, and we'll also, though we don't rely on these things, we do quite conveniently, I think, massage our assumptions to provide nice outputs. But actually, privately, you often often hear people saying, "No, this is we're just going to hell in a handcart." That's the language I would use. They're using their forms of phraseology. But yeah, that's very commonly the case when you put when you move the microphones away, when you're chatting over a coffee or a beer.
It's interesting. I was at an adaptation meeting a few months ago where the figure for sea level rise that was kind of accepted in the adaptation circles is 0.4 metres by the end of the century. But as soon as you go and have a beer in the pub afterwards, they're privately saying, 1 metre, 1.5 metres, because that's the figure that they've done the models themselves. They know what's coming. But what has to be reported is models that they can say that there's confidence in these models.
Now, that was something that James Hansen and I brought up at the last COP. Jim calls it scientific reticence. And it's a big problem that scientists won't say publicly what they will say privately.
But if you then start saying in the models that at the moment the models don't include feedbacks like Arctic ice, summer ice disappearing, there'll be less albedo, less reflection of sunlight from the Arctic. So the Arctic will warm up, we'll get perhaps release of methane from the permafrost. None of these feedbacks are in the models because, we don't understand them well enough to put them in the
models. Some are in the models, and as we get better understanding, they gradually get into the models. But I think it's really worth bearing in mind that lots of great science is going on in these areas, but there's lots of uncertainty. So to me, what we often require is, science is innately conservative, and the actual pure science models I'm very happy with. But what they need to go along with are very clear paragraphs or sets of assumptions. We have not included this for these reasons. These aren't included, and what might happen if these things end up being as bad as we think?
But it doesn't happen like that, because you get these reports, like that IPCC 1.5 report. Where does it mention the permafrost? And it's not as if the people reading it, not as if the journalists reading it, are going to say, by the way, this report doesn't include some important feedback. That never gets said.
No, it doesn't get. And actually, I think there is a role there for journalism, because actually the reports themselves, even if you look at something for policymakers, in the sort of the greyer text rather than the bold text, it does say these things. So I think there's an honesty there, but it's the role in the journalist to pick them out, particularly the really good journalists who are trying to inform the public, to put them there. But overall, I think the science is doing a good job, but these other caveats are really important and need to be emphasised much more than they are.
And including, there was a Nature article that we brought up the other day as well, including the caveat of the policy environment, the feedback loops of it's relying on a stable policy environment. We have to take a more conservative view of what actually is going to be implemented. Yeah. And as well as the emissions gap report, which came out the other day. Yeah. So we're talking about Paris here, but when you look at what's actually been committed there in terms of NDCs, it's way off where we need to be.
NDCs, please define your terms.
National Determined Contributions.
Those are the voluntary targets that nations can then lie about.
Yeah. It's also worth bearing in mind that we had the Global Carbon Project just report this year that the emissions in 2018 look they're going to be up something around about 2.7% growth. It was 1.6 last year, 2.7 this year. So we're going completely the wrong direction. So we're not even heading towards the NDCs, these pledges, these promises that are made. I do think we need to sort of almost stop and reflect that we are 28 years now on since the first report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The emissions are probably at 65% higher and are still going up. And we still meet in these events like this, and we still say the same things we've been saying for pretty much 28 years.
And the simple things that we can do are to be done by the richest 10%. Because if we're looking at this chart here again, are we going, not much point in asking the people that don't consume very much at all to consume less.
Yeah, I mean, that's always my point. This plot is a really good example. It comes from the work originally by Lucas Chancellor and Thomas Piketty in 2015 on carbon inequality, and then the infographic was done later. But basically, if you look at that, you can't squeeze carbon emissions out of people who hardly emit. And that's a sort of such a fundamental thing you get when you look at the data. But we're not, even in COP, we're not prepared to accept that.
I actually did my PhD on this very topic back in 2002. And when I spoke to someone from what's then DEFRA about why in the UK we're not focusing, I also studied in South Africa where the inequalities are really stark, why are we not focusing the efforts on the areas where we can make the most difference? It's just logical. And I was told that it's not politically viable.
No.
Well, so we often talk about, people should fly less. And then the retort is, flying only represents 2%, let's say, of global CO2 emissions. But isn't it right to say that the type of people who are flying lots are also the same people who've got high consumption lifestyles? So by picking out the people who fly a lot, are we also picking out the people who have other aspects of their lifestyles that are high emission?
Well, I think it's flying is emblematic. Of course, not everyone who flies will be very high emitters. Most of them will be. There'll be other people who occasionally fly for whatever reason who won't be. But it's emblematic of a very high carbon lifestyle. People who are the frequent flyers particularly, you know, academics amongst them, you know, we will live in typically larger houses than the average person. We'll drive a bigger car, we'll drive further, we'll consume more goods. You know, we go to a lot more conferences, we'll probably have more holidays away, we'll have weekend breaks somewhere. So almost every facet of our life is going to be much higher consumption.
So
the flying is, though, important as well. I mean, we have to bear in mind that everyone always says everything's only ever 2%. UK's 2%, California's 2%, flying's 2%, shipping's 2%, 50 times 2 is 100. 2% is important. Yeah. And actually, it's a particular industry here where there are no alternatives in the near term, near to medium term, to move away from it being locked into a high carbon infrastructure, and it's growing very rapidly. But it's not, it is not the only issue. There are many other issues to address.
We have a final quote.
It's a quote that came out of a Twitter discussion with Alex Steffen, who always makes really interesting comments. And he said, and I think it really captures where we are, winning slowly is basically the same thing as losing outright. In the face of both triumphant denialism, and we see that with the US, with Russia, with Qatar, with Saudi,
with Poland.
With Poland. And predatory delay. But we see that everywhere, whether that's Denmark, France, the UK, or Sweden, the progressive countries, whether it's the people intending us people attending COP. We see the predatory delay everywhere. Anything we can do to avoid making the changes today and passing the buck to the next generation. So we're all party to that. But then he goes on to say, to achieve climate action by doing the same things, the same old ways, means defeat. It guarantees defeat. And we've been doing the same things at COPs and discussing the same issues within our governments for 28 years, and the emissions are 65% higher. At some point, we have to wake up and smell the coffee. You know, we are failing abysmally, and we have to start to rethink this differently.
So if we should be flying less, why are we thinking about building a third runway at Heathrow Airport? We're doing the same thing all the time.
We're all, as you said by the dice here, we're all gambling. We were gambling on so many levels. We're gambling on technology in the future. We're gambling on the feedbacks. We're gambling on electric planes and all these other things that are there. So,
now, I'm going to have to end our brilliant discussion here. This has been another Scientist's Warning program. I'm your host, Stuart Scott, my co-host, Victoria Hirth. And we've been coming to you live from the UN climate negotiations, COP24 in Katowice, Poland. Thank you for joining us.
The goal of the United Planet Faith and Science Initiative is to bring scientists and religious leaders together to mobilize action, not just talk, for justice and ecological sustainability. This program was produced off the electric grid with solar power in the mountains of Northern California. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.